Hey, good morning. So, last time we wrapped up our discussion of cellular telephony by looking at sort of 4G and where all the technology was going. And the idea was that we wanted very high data rates, sort of broadband data rates in a mobile context. And additionally, we wanted sort of mobility over heterogeneous networks so you can move from, one mobile technology or provider to another seamlessly and potentially interact with things like we're going to see today, wireless LANs, if you're in the sort of range of a wireless LAN, you can hand over to that as well. And we saw there are two main contenders in terms of standards. There's the LTE Advanced standard put forward by the cellular telephony concerns. And then there's the WiMAX standard, which is part of the IEEE 802 family of standards, which primarily are designed to specify point-to-point connectivity and the technology involved in that, so the physical and the data link layer. The 802 standards arise from the data networks side of things, so not from the telephony side of things, and have always been concerned with packet transport. Okay, so just in terms of looking forward to what's going to happen for the rest of term, we have two examinable topics left. We have what we'll cover today, the 802.11 standard. Next week, we'll discuss Bluetooth. And in week 12, there will be a guest lecture on ad hoc networking. So it's sort of the complete extreme from the mobile telephony cellular side of things, complete chaos in a way, and sort of complete lack of control. And so it's interesting to contrast how those operate. Just again, gives you a broader viewpoint. The rest of the lecture slots that's not taken up by discussing these topics will be devoted to help sessions for the assignment. And so I'll post the exact times sort of later this week, early next week, the first one of which is today after this lecture. But the demonstrator, Martin Kennedy, will be available in the master's lab to help you out and discuss any issues you might be having with the assignments. If you're a remote student and cannot make those help sessions, that's fine. Just feel free to contact Martin one-on-one about any questions you might have. And if you're here and need some help outside of those times, the same applies. Just send him an email and he'll deal with you, sort of in due course. So, to the topic at hand, wireless local area networks, and specifically 802.11, which is the main standard governing wireless LANs. The idea always of a local area network is to provide point-to-point connectivity for machines connected to this network and to provide sort of connectivity into a broader network, you would typically have an access point or a gateway of some sort. So the machine could try and connect to this access point, which would forward everything onto the wider network. Again, these are governed by the IEEE 802 standards, not just wireless LANs, but all sorts of local area networks, so Ethernet as 802.16, so the WiMAX also falls into this, again, as a sort of access connectivity. Metropolitan, some metropolitan area network standards as well. Token rings, token buses, there's a whole slew of standards associated. And basically what's defined for these standards is the physical layer technology and the data link layer. And usually what's important at the data link layer, well, it's all important, but what sort of distinguishes the different flavors at the data link layer is the form of medium access control. And frequently, again, this is going to be somewhat dependent on what the physical layer does. Okay, so Stallings has a chapter here which contains most of what will be covered today. And so, what is the attractiveness of wireless LANs? Well, primarily not having wires. So you don't need to install physical connection points for your equipment. And so this allows for a limited form of mobility, in that if I'm connected here to a wireless network, it doesn't matter if I'm sitting on the left-hand side or the right-hand side, as long as I'm within range of the access point. Handover is catered for to some extent, but it's not as big, and the idea is not to provide wide-scale coverage over a large area. It's typically it's a local area network, so it's of a limited range. Okay, and because you don't have to provide all these physical connection points, it's very easy to deploy. It can be quite inexpensive. Expansion is easy, and again, in an extreme case, you can sort of do away with all infrastructure altogether and just have devices talking to each other. We're not really going to, again, pursue that here, but it's possible, and it's catered for. Okay. And so, again, this leads to a lot of applications and, again, sort of much more flexible connection. It allows for much more flexible network access. You can go into your local Starbucks and get network connectivity. So what are the disadvantages? Speed. And I should also say speed in conjunction with capacity, sort of how many users can be catered for. It tends to be slower than wired networks. You can get good speeds. 802.11n, the sort of latest standard, allows you to get up to, at least in theory, 600 megabits per second. So you're getting decent speeds, but you're not getting the type of speeds that you would get necessarily out of a wired network. Ethernet is up to gigabits. And in conjunction with that, there are capacity issues, sort of how many users can be supported at that sort of speed at any given time. Security is a clear issue. You know, again, we've discussed it or touched on it in terms of cellular networks. So you have all the issues of authentication and of data protection. Because, you know, you can't sort of physically protect the airwaves. Anybody can receive the signal, so you have to make sure that people can't make sense of that signal. Again, in terms of reliability, there's, you know, a much higher error rate for radio than for wires, and, yeah, a limited range. Nevertheless, it's quite clearly a very viable and popular solution to providing local area network connectivity. So the dominant standard is the 802.11 standard. And again, if you've messed around with this at all, you know there's quite a few flavors of it. But they also fall under the 802.11 heading. They work in the license-exempt spectrum, which means that they occasionally have to contend with other technologies that are working in that same spectrum. IEEE is the standards body, and then the Wi-Fi Alliance is responsible for certifying compliance with that standard. Similar to the way that... Okay. So, the ISM band varies from country to country. It's sort of lightly regulated, so for instance, there's a limit on the maximum transmit power you can use in that band, so you can't sort of blast everybody else out of existence. But lots of technologies will operate in that same band, so you can sort of have issues with that. Okay. So what sorts of setups can we have? Network architectures? We'll have two basic flavors. Again, we can have an ad hoc network in which each of the devices just communicates directly with the other, or we can have our communication occurring through an access point. And this through an access, so an infrastructure-based solution. This through an access point would be a much more common way of setting things up. And so the access point, again, facilitates communications between various devices, and it also provides connectivity into the core network, so into the internet. Okay, or potentially has that facility. Okay, so in terms of terminology, the stations that are communicating with each other are referred to as a basic service set. And then the service set identifier identifies sort of the membership in that basic service set and the users are referred to as stations, and again they can connect directly with other stations or they can connect to access points. Now again, typically the connectivity is going to be limited by range, and so 802.11 allows for an extension of that range via sort of multiple access points, which then are connected through some wired backbone, typically an Ethernet backbone. Okay. And so the access points that are connected together to form will form a single virtual entity and will have a single shared identifier. Okay, and so then the user can move between access points and still remain connected to the same network. Okay, so that's the basic setup. Probably the best one to sort of fix in your head while we're doing this discussion is the idea of an access point and a bunch of stations. The rest is sort of detail, or just sort of additional features. Now, all of the 802.11 standards fit sort of neatly on the TCP/IP stack and slightly more messily onto the OSI stack. Again, the basic idea is that they're providing the point-to-point connectivity, so they're defining a physical layer and a data link layer. And again, the 802 family is quite a large selection of these standards. So Ethernet, 802.11, ICN, ATM, token rings, token LANs, token buses, WiMAX, all of which have sort of different physical characteristics and different medium access. On top of that, they all share a common logic link control layer, which again, that provides sort of control of your point of your connection. Okay, so you can do things like set up the connection between your station and your access point through the 802 logic link control, and then when you're sending data, you have to contend for the access to the medium through whatever MAC protocol applies. Okay. Now, in the case of 802.11, there is not a single physical layer defined, but a number of physical layers defined, and they're distinguished by the frequency range in which they operate and the technology which they use. So how do they transmit data? Excuse me. Hopefully I can get through this lecture. It's a horrible coughing attack. But actually, quite a, I mentioned a couple of the technologies. Some of them use OFDM, some of them use direct sequence spread spectrum. 802.11n uses MIMO techniques as well. But that's sort of the tip of the iceberg. Loads of different physical possibilities have been identified. We'll concentrate primarily on the OFDM and the MIMO, but just be aware there are a number of different ones identified. Okay, so to distinguish between all of these flavors, you have the 802.11 standard, which is sort of a baseline, and then you have a large number of amendments, and each amendment sort of specifies something very specific. A good few of them have to do with the specification of the data link and PHY layers. Some others just apply to the Mac and do things like quality of service or security. The naming scheme is done on a letter basis, and the letters are just assigned in order of when the working groups are formed, which is distinct from when they actually produce something in the end. Okay, so just the table here gives the main flavors of Mac PHY standards, and so here we have A, B, G, and N, and what we see again is that they are distinguished by their technology. Some use OFDM, some use direct sequence spread spectrum. Again, others have been considered, but these are the main ones that are actually out there. And the frequency band on which they operate. Now, primarily based on what sort of technology they're using, different data rates can be achieved. And so, just as a note, the data rate is sort of, in a perfect world, if you have one user, what can be, how fast can they blast out the data? Throughput refers to a more typical scenario where you have more than one user and they're having to coexist, and what sort of data rates will they experience in that case. Okay, so those are the main PHY standards, and again, there's a number of other amendments which deal with sort of various issues arising. So 802.11e deals with quality of service provision for these networks. So your basic flavor is just a contention-based system. You fight your corner and get in it as best you can. The quality of service allows for the favoring of different classes of traffic. 802.11i presents an enhanced security standard. F is sort of inter-access point protocols, so allowing the access points to coordinate. S is mesh networking, so again, providing sort of broad, wider networking possibilities. K and R, K is radio resource management, and So allowing some coordination on that. And R is a handover. Okay, so we won't look in detail at, well, you could argue we aren't looking in detail at any of them, but we'll mention a few of the main points about 802.11e. We'll note something about I. The rest of them, just, you know, again, be aware that the people do think about various issues having to do with the sort of internet working. So, what we'll do now is have a look at sort of the basics that are common to all the flavors of 802.11, and following on from that, again, we'll say a few words about 802.11n. Which is interesting, again, because it's using the same sorts of technologies that we're seeing in the 4G type world. Okay, so if you have this network set up, how does a station join it? Well, beacon frames are used to announce the existence of the network, so the access point periodically transmits these beacon frames at sort of a low data rate but maximum power, so they can be, so that gives you the maximum range for the network. And they provide synchronization and identification information. A station that wants to join has two options. It can passively scan for these beacon frames, and then sort of when it finds one, use that information to join. Or it can do what's called active scanning, which is to transmit a probe request, which the access point will respond to with a beacon frame sending its information. Okay. Once the user has found the network, then a process of association and authentication has to occur. So the user has to, again, potentially provide its credentials for gaining access to the network, and then sort of again associate itself with the network, so exchange basic identity information. Yeah. When transmitting data in this environment, it's assumed that there is going to be a higher loss rate than for wired networks, and for this reason, it's required that each frame is individually acknowledged. Now, this has actually been relaxed in the N standard, but by and large, you assume each frame has been acknowledged, and if the acknowledgement is not received, then the frame is retransmitted. So this is you know, again, a flavor of your basic ARQ protocols. Now, in terms of gaining access to the medium, the most common form is a distributed coordination function, which provides for a contention-based medium access. So like your old Ethernet, you transmit, you listen, you see if there was a collision. If there is, you back off. Okay. The standard also allows for a centrally controlled medium access through the point coordination function. And here you have to have a coordinator, the access point, which will regulate the medium access. Okay, so essentially it pulls the stations and sees who wants to transmit and tells them when they can transmit. Associated with the 802.11e standard, there's a third option, which is the hybrid coordination function. And it sort of builds on the point coordination function, but now distinguishes traffic type and allocates resources according to that traffic type. And we'll see how that works. We'll say a few words about that later on. Okay, so again, our basic flavor of medium access is a contention-based medium access called carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance. And the basic operation is that if a station wants to send, it listens to the channel. If the channel appears to be idle, it'll start transmitting. If the channel's not idle, it goes into backoff, so it retries after a certain somewhat random time. Again, if a collision occurs, it retries after a random time, then repeats. Oh, rats. Excuse me, I think the slides have gone out of order now. Or maybe not. Okay. So, this sort of policy is sort of a direct carryover from policies that are used in wired LAN. So Ethernet, the original Ethernet was a contention-based strategy, quite similar to this. The wired aspect leads to a few issues that are not, the wireless aspect leads to a few issues that are not present in the wired networks. And specifically, there's an issue of the boundaries of the network. If you're on a shared bus, then everybody hears everything that's going on. If you're in a wireless situation, you only hear if you're actually in the range. So, potentially, we have an example here where you have three stations. The one in the middle can probably hear one and three. Station one can hear station two, but can't hear station three, doesn't know it exists. And station three similarly can't hear station one, doesn't know it exists because it's out of range. And so if you think what happens with this carrier sense, for instance, one might be transmitting to two, three won't hear that, so it'll listen to the medium and conclude it's free to transmit. And once three starts transmitting to two,
there will be a collision and the data will be lost.
Okay. So that's something that would not happen in a wired situation, but can happen just because of ranges for a wireless network. The ranges cause sort of the reverse problem as well. It's called the exposed node problem now, which is actually not so much a problem as not exploiting the benefits of this range idea. And the idea is that if you have communications that are sort of not within, which are in separate ranges, then potentially you could have multiple communications going on at the same time, and they wouldn't interfere with each other, sort of if they're far enough away from each other. So you could have multiple communications going on at the same time and not interfere with each other. Okay, so an example of this is we have node 1 transmitting, doesn't matter where, and maybe node 2 wants to transmit then to node 3. Okay, node 2 is going to sense that the medium is busy and back off, but in actuality, well, I mean, it actually does matter where one wants to transmit. One wants to transmit to somebody out here. Node 2 senses that there's something going on and doesn't transmit. But if the someone out here is not in node 2's range, there would be actually no problem with them transmitting to node 3. So node 1 can transmit to node 4 out of the range of node 3, and so 2 could then transmit to node 3, and those two transmissions would not interfere with each other. Okay. So this is, it's almost a way of sort of, it's almost a way that with the wireless connectivity you can optimize your transmissions. Okay. So, addition to this protocol has been defined now, which deals with the request with the hidden and exposed station problems. And this is in the form of additional control signaling of request to send and clear to send. Okay. And for request to send and clear to send, now the conclusions that the station makes in terms of whether they're free to send or not is based on which of the request to send, clear to send pair they have actually heard. Okay. So, in, again, the case of the hidden station problem, we have node 1 transmitting to node 2. And so node 1 would transmit a request to send before it started transmitting to node 2. And that would not be heard by node 3. But node 2 would transmit a clear to send to node 1, assuming it was, of course. And that clear to send
would be heard by node 3. So upon hearing the clear to send from node 2, node 3 would come to the conclusion that node 2 is busy, I'd better not transmit. Now, in terms of the exposed station problem, again, if node 1 wanted to transmit to node 4, which is out of range of everybody, it would send a request to send. Node 3 wouldn't hear that. It would then send, node 4 would transmit a clear to send. That also wouldn't be heard. And so if neither of those are heard, then it means that, you know, it's in its own separate range, so you don't need to worry. Nobody else is going to interfere with it. Okay. Now, if you think about it, this isn't always used because of the overheads that it's inducing. Obviously, you know, it's a lot more signaling, and that signaling is in for contention as well. Okay, so there are a number of additional mechanisms sort of that make that basic mechanism work a bit more smoothly, or make sort of the network run a bit more smoothly. The network allocation vector is used to make the carrier sensing easier for stations. If you're talking about mobile devices, they're running on a battery, and carrier sensing, every time it's done, is consuming energy. So what the NAV does is it provides information about the duration of a transmission. And so instead of having to periodically do the carrier sensing, the device knows that for a time duration, the channel will be busy. If it receives the NAV, it knows that information. And so it won't start its carrier sensing until after that time duration has expired. Okay. So, another modification to this basic protocol is to define different what's called interframe spacings. And so again, this should have been moved forward, but the idea here is that we do our carrier sensing, and even if the medium is idle, we wait a certain amount of time to transmit, called an interframe spacing. And if it's still idle, then we transmit. Okay. If it's not idle, we wait for the end of the current transmission, wait this interframe spacing amount, and again, check whether it's idle. And those have to be wrong. Oh, okay, no, that's correct. If once it goes into idle, you also think, since we've had a non-idle period, you go into our back off and then transfer the frame. Okay, So, the sort of addition here is to weight the interframe spacing time, and
what this allows is us to insert a bit of priority into the system by defining different interframe spacing times. And as you can see, the shorter the interframe spacing time, the less time you have to wait, the quicker you can get in and try and access the medium. Okay. So shorter interframe spacing time leads to essentially a higher priority, a better chance of getting access to the medium. Okay. And so 4 times are defined as short IFS, which is sort of the highest priority and gives priority to request to send, clear to send, and acts. And again, you can sort of see why those would be important to get through. The DIFS IFS is the sort of minimum time that sort of your regular packets can get through. The PCFS is used for point control functions, and the EIFS is a variable value that's used when there's been some sort of error. So again, by varying these times, you can sort of favor certain packets being transmitted over others. Okay. So, how much time is any node going to wait? After a frame transmission, every node waits at least this DIFS, and then plus a contention window. Okay. The contention window is divided into fixed time slots, and so you start with a minimum, and then the waiting time is randomly selected amongst this contention window. So if two nodes select the same time, then they'll collide. If they don't, they won't. Okay. Every time you have a collision, the contention window then goes up exponentially, typically capped at a maximum of 1023. And so what that means is that sort of the more contention you have, you're spreading out then the period over which various stations will retransmit. So the longer that is, and since it's random, you hope that eventually one of them will get in first and not have a collision. There's also a retry limit set of 7, so if it's really a disaster, then eventually your station will give up. Okay. So once either the frame is transmitted or the station gives up, the station resets to its minimum contention window and moves on from there. Okay, so that's the basic operation of the MAC protocol. We'll have a little look at the frame format. Again, just keep in mind that this is all sitting in this layered architecture, and the idea is that each layer is adding their own bit of information. And again, this is the information added by 802.11. So basically, what we have is control information and addressing, and there are four address fields. Two are associated with the two stations, and two are associated with the potentially two different access points that those stations are connected to. So if you think about the full thing where you have multiple access points, which the stations can be connected to, then you'll have all of these addresses in use. Overall, there's an overhead of 34 bytes, and then within that we have a frame body of up to 2312 bytes. So just looking at again very quickly what each of these does, the frame control indicates what protocol version is being used. The frame type, so is it management or data, what sort of information is contained within the frame, down to a subtype, so you'd be very specific about the information. And whether it's to or from the distribution system, so is it coming in from the internet or out to the internet, or neither. Okay. So, there's moving on, there's information about whether the frame has been fragmented. If the information is a retry, if the frame is being retransmitted. Power management indications, so if the sending station is going to power down, it lets the receiver know. More data, so is more data available to be sent? Is security being used? And an order bit, so what order is in use? Okay, so additionally, we have a duration, and so that indicates how long the transmission will take, based on, again, the size of the frame, and is used to set the nav vector. And if polling is being used, it's used to indicate the access point you have to when to wake up. Okay, so again, there are four addresses, and these have to do with specifying the stations and the access points. The body holds the payload and specifies again up to over 2,000 bytes. Again, moving on to the IP layer, there's a maximum size of 1,500 bytes, so this is going to necessitate sort of fragmentation, so the data is going to be chunked up just to satisfy the different requirements. Finally, sequence control is used within the ARQ process to make sure you just get one sequence of frames, so the frames are numbered, and the ARQ uses that numbering to get the whole sequence. And frame check sequence is the coding used to check whether the frame is in error or not. So the combination of sequence control and frame control sequences used in the ARQ process to retransmit data that's in error. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of control frames. So power save pull requests frames from the access point that the station wouldn't have received while it was in power save, while it was sort of powered down. The request to send, the clear to send, the acknowledgments that we've discussed before in terms of medium access control, and also indications about when contention-free periods begin and end. So again, if we have a controlled access to the medium for a period, you have to signal when that's over, or when it started, for that matter. Okay, there are 8 frame types. And again, these are distinguished by the type of information they carry and how it's organized. So there's 4 to carry data from source to destination. And so it either just contains the data or it piggybacks on control information as well. Okay. And then 4 are used specifically for control. So null just indicates power management. The rest are, again, denoting when contention-free periods begin and end. Management frames are used to set up the connection between stations and access points. So the request and response information, beacons to allow stations to find the network at all, and then sort of authentication, the exchange of authentication information. Okay, so this slide has some bearing on your assignment. The question is, why do you have this idealized throughput and sort of the non-ideal throughput, sort of what you actually get out of the system? And the answer is that you have to look at this in the context of this layered architecture. And so, on the one hand, you get a certain number of bits through, but on the other hand, there's a lot of mechanisms that are going on to get those bits through correctly and to coordinate. So, at the MAC layer, you have contention. So if you know, it's one thing if you're the only one, then you can sort of blast away. If you're not, then you're having to negotiate with other stations to get access to the medium, so you don't have constant access to the medium. At the TCP layer, depending on whether you're using TCP or UDP, there are mechanisms, again, that regulate how much data you can send at any given time. So the combination, so all these mechanisms are sort of acting independently, but combined together, the bottom line is that you aren't just transmitting all the time. Okay. So that's pretty, well, so that's sort of the basics of the Mac. Now, again, there are additional issues which are included to manage various aspects of wireless networks. I mentioned security. I don't go into any detail on it because it's not really the... I think there are other modules that deal with security in detail. But the initial attempt at security in 802.11 was the Wireless Equivalency Protocol, WEP, and this used some form of encryption. And the bottom line was that it wasn't actually very secure. Okay. In response to that, again, the 802.11i standard proposed the wireless protected access, and the final version is WPA version 2, and this has better encryption and is thought to be adequate anyway. Okay. I'm just mentioning it. If you're into security, then you get more information in the RFC. Okay. So we'll return to the Mac later to say a few words about quality of service. But for now, we'll look, those are sort of basic Mac issues. Now we look at the physical layer. And so within the physical layer, you have a convergence procedure and then the physical medium dependent layer at the bottom, which is actually responsible for transmitting the bits. And so the convergence procedure just, again, mediates between the Mac and the actual physical layer. Okay. Now, the channels defined for your basic 802.11, so B, G, and G, are 20 megahertz, and they're defined in an overlapping fashion, again, to try and work around sort of other technologies that might be in use. But what this means is that you only have a fairly small number of non-overlapping channels to use. Okay. And as I said before, a very large number of different physical layers are defined or have been proposed. The only ones that are sort of in use at all are the direct sequence spread spectrum and the orthogonal frequency division multiplexing. The sort of most modern 802.11phi standard is the 802.11n. Excuse me. And yeah, as we saw, sort of again as we marched through the cellular, it's using quite similar techniques to try and improve the bandwidth. So 802.11n allows 20 megahertz channels, but also 40 megahertz channels, so two different with channels, obviously, the bigger the bandwidth, the more bits you can push through it. It's based on OFDM, and also uses MIMO techniques to... It uses MIMO techniques to both increase the bandwidth and also improve the quality of the signal. Okay. So the way MIMO is used is, again, both in spatial multiplexing, so sending different data along different paths through the same channel, so that increases your bit rate, and also space-time block coding, so allowing coding as well, sending redundant data as well to improve the quality of the signal. Beamforming can also be used to direct the signal in a way to optimize the power. Up to 4x4 connections are defined, so 4 antennas on the station, 4 at the access point. So the transmission is defined in terms of sort of the whole scheme, in terms of modulation and coding. So you have different ways of modulating the bits with potentially more than one bit sent per signal. And then some of those bits are devoted to redundancy. So typically that's denoted K slash N, where for every K bits of data, N bits are transmitted. So whatever over K is redundancy. Additionally, the guard interval can be specified. There's two choices. The channel bandwidth, as we say, can be 20 megahertz or 40 megahertz. And the number of spatial streams used can be defined. So anything from 1 to 4 spatial streams can be used. And so to keep track of that all, this is defined in the modulation and coding scheme, and it's just numbered then from 1 to 78. From 0 to 77. And each of those numbers indicates some permutation on these values. So a different modulation coding scheme, different coding rate, different guard at interval, etc. Okay, and just to pop to the figure, this is the first 31. And again, you'll see there's a different number of spatial streams, a different number of modulation types, so you get a different number of bits per signal, a different coding rate, so a different ratio of how many of those bits are data to redundancy, either 20 megahertz or 40 megahertz channels, either 800 nanosecond or 400 nanosecond guard intervals. And what pops out of that, again, is a different data rate up to 600 megabits per second. So the first 32 of these values denote with a fixed modulation type and coding scheme, which means that no matter how many paths, whether you're using 1 or 4, well, more significantly, if you're using more than one path, spatial path, then they're all going to use the same modulation scheme and the same coding scheme. Values 32 through 37 allow different spatial streams, so different paths to use different modulation types and different coding and different coding schemes. Access points must all support at least, they have to be certified 802.11n, must support at least the first 16 of these, and the stations must support at least the first 7. So that gets you to
up to 2 spatial streams supported,
although the stations can leave it at 1 spatial stream supported. Okay, so our last topic is security. And so, again, this is defined in the 802.11 quality of service, defined in the 802.11e standard. And so there are 2 options here, hybrid control function and EDCA. Hybrid control function works off of the point control function, and since the point control function is not really implemented, the hybrid control function isn't really implemented either. And so it works quite similarly to the point control function in offering a contention-free period, but it has a few extras. The access point can initiate this contention-free period at any time it thinks it's necessary. So if it's aware of, again, time-sensitive data, then it can sort of favor that data. And it finds traffic classes and traffic streams and allows service on a per stream basis. Okay. So it's just, it's the access point control, it has sort of additional control over the allocation of resources, and again, it can use it to favor certain traffic over other traffic. EDCA is used in conjunction with DCF, and again, the goal is to allow sort of different medium access options for different traffic classes, and give higher priority for certain classes. And so it defines 4 classes, 2 of which are essentially best effort, then a voice class and a video class, and again defines classes and streams. Defines classes. And then for each class, it's going to set a number of parameters. So the contention window can be set, and with, again, shorter contention windows giving higher priority. The interframe spacing can be set with shorter interframe spacing for higher priorities, and then a transmission opportunity can be set. And a transmission opportunity is a time interval in which a station can send as many frames as possible. So when the station gets access to the medium, it's not just for one frame, it's for a number of frames. Okay, and so, again, the traffic gets divided into these classes, and so the same contention mechanisms are used, but because of the setting of the interframe spacing and the contention window, the higher priority classes are going to have a better chance of getting access. Then, once they do get access for a longer period of time. Okay, and again, this is just an example of how those might be set. For your best effort traffic, your contention window can go up to the max, whereas for video and voice, it's the contention window is kept quite short. Okay. Again, background traffic has higher interframe spacing, and background traffic has no maximum transmission opportunity, so background traffic will just get to send one frame. Video and voice have larger transmission opportunities, and as you would expect, video has a larger transmission opportunity than voice. So that means if you're sending video, you get to send for longer. So try and get that through. Okay, so what did we cover today? 802.11 is part of the 802 family, and it primarily defines the physical and data link layer, and primarily the physical and MAC layers for local area networks for sort of point-to-point connectivity. 802.11 will have evolved from the wired local area network standards, specifically Ethernet. A number of different physical options are defined. Most common ones are the direct sequence spread spectrum and the OFDM. And it's a sort of most modern version is 802.11n, which uses OFDM, MIMO, larger bandwidths, same things we saw for LTE Advanced and for WiMAX to try and achieve higher data rates. And so the MAC is primarily contention-based, and we saw that there's sort of a lot of issues surrounding doing it in a wireless setting, and there is quality of service support available. So that went on a bit longer than I thought. So if you want to take a short break, take a short break. Martin Kennedy will be in the master's lab. So if you have questions about your assignment, you can go on over to the master's lab and talk to him about them. Again, he should be available for the next few weeks. For some or all of this time slot, I'll post the schedule on Moodle. If you're not able to make those times, then again, feel free to contact him via email, and he'll be happy to deal with you on that basis as well. Okay, so I'll see you guys next week.